One of the many shocks I experienced in seminary was how it turned me into a Bible lover, especially the Hebrew Bible. I mean, I thought Bible would be my least favorite requirement, but I actually ended up taking Bible electives. Someday we'll have to do a Bible series here, and you can all see if you end up shocking yourselves too. But until then, I appreciate Sundays like today, where I get to spend some time digging into this text, especially when the text is what many traditional Bible readers would call problematic. Problematic texts and characters in the Bible are my favorite. And Esther, the text, and the character are both quite problematic. The text is a human-centered story of communal bravery and political maneuvering with no mention of God. You can see some might find that problematic. The character of Esther is the hero, not always a clear-cut one, actually. She was a woman in ancient Persia who held the fate of the Jewish people in her hands. You can see some might find that also problematic. Scholars think the book of Esther was written somewhere in the 4th or century before the Common Era. It was as a way of speaking creatively to Jews in diaspora, that is, those who were attempting to live under an oppressive imperial rule. The book tried to answer two questions. First, how could or should Jews navigate the empire that they were living in, without any official power, and without connection to one another? How could they ensure their way of life, their people, their survival? Or to put it more simply, and perhaps in a way that feels more relevant to today, what does it mean to be faithful in the context of empire? The second question was a little more basic. It was just like, what's the story behind this big festival we call Purim, which had been going on for some time before the final editing of the text? As Sue Ellen described, Purim is a fun celebratory holiday where people dress up in costumes, share food and treats, and help those with fewer resources, and drink too much. Seriously, every description I found about Purim includes a reference to drinking and too much. To the point, in fact, where you might forget who you are. The reason for this is the same reason as the costumes, it turns out, because Esther, in the story, pretended to be someone that she wasn't. And also, she blurred the lines between those who had power and those who did not. The story of Esther doesn't start there, though. It starts with another queen called Vashti, who was having marriage trouble, as in she'd come to realize that she was married to a real jerk. Her husband, King Xerxes, was an egomaniac, obsessed with displaying his wealth and showing off what a big shot he was. He threw party after party for the palace guests, even while those outside the palace were struggling, even in poverty. Oh, I should have said, as I'm telling the story, feel free to draw contemporary parallels in your mind. If any come to mind. Queen Vashti was fed up. She stopped going to the palace parties, and instead she threw a women's-only party for all the women in the palace who were equally disgusted. The king eventually noticed that Vashti wasn't at his parties, and so he called her to him because he wanted to show her off. She was so beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come. So the king divorced her and banned her from the palace and, yes, executed her, and then went looking for a new queen who would know her place. This is where we meet Esther. Esther is the woman who did what she was told, the well-behaved one, the woman who knew her place. See, a little problematic. It is why she became the queen, actually, not because of her wealth or her family ties, for she had neither. She was an immigrant Jew living in Persia, adopted by her cousin Mordecai after her parents had died. Which is maybe why when she came to the palace, she didn't tell anyone who she really was, that she was a Jew, thus the costumes and the drinking. She didn't share her background or her story because she knew it would only really cause confusion and question. It didn't take long for King Xerxes to fall in love with Esther. She knew her place. So he placed a royal crown upon her head, and she became the new queen. There were parties, just as before, excessive displays, and through it all, Esther played her part, still never mentioning her background. Until one day, one of the king's advisors, Haman, asked the king to kill all the Jews living in the empire. And in a careless act of vanity, the king said, "Sure." When I read this story again this week, as at this part I thought about Elizabeth Wynne's beautiful construct that Sean introduced last week, where for some of us, some things are news, while for others of us, they are family. King Xerxes thought he was just sort of making news. He didn't realize that actually he was dealing with family. Mordecai, that's, remember, Queen Esther's cousin slash adopted father, he eventually came running to Esther, begging for her help, and she was like, "Who, me? What could I do?" I mean, even if she tried, she thought he'd probably just kill her. I mean, she knew her place. But Mordecai, her family, kept insisting. He said, "Don't think that just because you live in the king's house, that you're the one Jew who will get out of this alive. I mean, if you persist in being silent, help may arrive from someplace else, but before then, you and your family will likely be wiped out." "Who's to say," he asked, "whether you have come to this place and this position for just such a time as this?" We are so far away now from kings and queens, crowns and thrones and palaces. I sometimes wonder if that Howard Thurman quote, that description of that crown placed above our heads, if it completely translates to us in the way he intended. I mean, when I say prince, I mean, be honest, at least a good portion of you, immediately your first thought is the singer, right? Right. Or if I say prince, maybe you got the Disney character in mind. Maybe a few actual princes. But less likely, an image of a great leader grounded in a holy calling. But this is what the monarchy was once considered, or at least it was the ideal that was quickly corrupted. But the intent was leaders who were chosen by God to lead the people through a particular time and place, leaders whose gifts and wisdom were especially needed for that time. The crown is never ahistorical, because it represents that contextual charge to act for the common good, given the actual reality that the monarch may be facing. I know the ideal is probably like never our actual reality, but it was the hope. Last week, I had the chance to sit with the new president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. The last time that she and I had been able to talk, it was before her election, last June, and so I was wondering how she was doing. I mean, not with the role, I mean, not the job. I've kind of seen she's doing great in the job, but just with the role. You know, I jokingly then referenced the 1998 movie Elizabeth, which portrays Queen Elizabeth's rise, and the moment at the end of the film that has stuck with me ever since I saw it, when Elizabeth finally concedes that she can no longer be the person that she had been before she was the queen, if she's going to be the queen that England needs her to be. She'd been this playful, complex, passionate human being, but then in that moment when she realizes, she appears transformed, pale, overly costumed, with an icy glare. Not a person, really, just more like a projection. This embodiment of power, this performance of queen. I mean, it was a joke. Obviously, there are many differences between the UUA president and the Queen of England. But I thought of it because there is something in this role that she's stepped into that requires a transformation, whether internal or external, maybe both, an expectation that moves her, in her mind and in ours, from a fellow colleague, friend, or mother, even simply person, to president. We have ideas in our heads about leaders, whether they are queens or presidents or city officials or corporate bosses, activists or even ministers. We have a sense of what it means, what it takes, what sort of person gets a crown, or even who deserves a crown, despite our theology implying otherwise. We have messages hardwired in us, taking shape from the youngest age, messages about what responsibility means, or what success is, what leadership looks like, and most of all, who has the power and capacity to make real change and who does not. All of these messages manifest in the shoulds of life, that is, the knowing our place and acting accordingly. As an example, I recently realized that one of my hardwired messages is that what it means to be responsible is to worry. The message is, if I'm not worried, then I'm probably missing something. Probably foolish, maybe even downright incompetent. I mean, if I'm going to be responsible, then I should worry. This should, however, is entirely contrary to all of my training and all I know of best practices, because being responsible actually requires the opposite. It requires a non-anxious, non-worrying presence, a posture of trust. And this should, this hardwired message, gets in the way of me claiming the real power that is available to me, that authentic power that is just mine. We often know that these hardwired messages are wrong, but also they are deep. Like Esther, the pull to pretend or to pass, to know your place and to put on costumes to get by, is perpetual for all of us. Still today, we all struggle to navigate a world where our values are always at risk, a world where we too feel the effects of diaspora, which I translate in my mind to a profound experience of disconnection and dislocation. I mean, resistance may be a poetic ideal, but then we remember Vashti, who resisted the summons of the empire, and remember what happened to her. In the text, Esther, I found it interesting, she never actually answers Mordecai's great question about whether or not she was there specifically for a time such as this. She never says any words back. Instead, she gets dressed up in some fancy clothes, which I kind of imagine her still thinking about it, even as she continues to play her part. She puts herself in proximity to the king, kind of undemanding, unassuming, still knowing her place. But then this time, she uses her place to access her power. For once again, he professes his love for her. He says, you can have whatever you want. And she decides right then to come out. She tells the king, if he goes through with it, this order to kill the Jews, he would be killing her people and killing her. News becomes family, and he acts. The threat, over. Purim, like Carnival or Halloween or to some extent Mardi Gras, invites us to literally costume ourselves with the transgressive intent that we might better notice the costumes of cultural expectations that many of us wear often unintentionally every day. And in turn grants us a permission to try on a different role, a different life, to act outside the shoulds, and to discover there instead the authentic role that is just ours to play. The crown that is just ours, placed there, you might say, by God, or maybe we might say by the ancestors, or maybe by the vast network of people alive today who call us as partners, invite us to step fully into our power, or maybe by the beckoning future and the generations to come who need us to step up, not to perform queen, but to be the queen or king, or whatever royalty that only we can be, to claim and use the power that only we have. 2 weeks ago, the Sunday after the shooting in Florida, I came here, right here, and I confessed I was feeling helpless. I urged us all to recognize that although we cannot solve everything, we do have some power. But over the last week, young people across the country, including here in Fort Collins, have blown through right through such qualifiers as some power and showed us what it looks like to rise to the call of our times and to claim the full power that is available to us. Their sense of urgency and call, courage and creativity is inspiring and reminds us that, as Tim Kreider wrote in the New York Times this week, power is like money. Imaginary, entirely dependent upon belief. Kreider goes on to say, most of the power of institutions lies in the faith that people have in them. And cynicism is also a kind of faith, that faith that nothing can change, that institutions are corrupt beyond all accountability. But, he says, once people stop believing in the invulnerability of these same institutions or the inevitability of the unjust status quo, their destruction can come swiftly. And as poet Seamus Heaney says, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. Of course, we don't know yet what will come of it all. And we never do. We never do. We never know when a turning point will come, what transformation is possible. And these young activists, like the Black Lives Matter activists before them, or the Occupy movement before that, or so many youth movements before those, each remind us that there is nothing inevitable about this situation that we find ourselves in, nothing natural. We created this world, and we can create another one. Last week, Sean offered us a vision for how this sort of massive change might happen as he invited us to show up with intention to our circles of influence, the 8 to 15 people that we are closest to. He said, start there. And then crunching the numbers, he said, if we each do that, then we have the capacity to influence and engage over 50% of Larimer County. It's a powerful vision, especially because it's a scale that we can get our heads around. I mean, I can't totally imagine having influence over 50% of Larimer County, but I can think about the 8 to 15. And I mean, I know I can't fix the whole world. And thinking about it often overwhelms and even immobilizes me. But as activist Adrienne Marie Brown imagines, I can see my life, my work, and relationships as a front line as a first place that I can practice justice, liberation, and alignment with others and the planet. Which admittedly takes Sean's vision just a little farther than he did last week. Charging us not to just show up in relationship with those 8 to 15, like, you know, really care in your circle together with your 8 to 15, but to do so in specific ways that manifest justice and liberation for everyone. To show up in a way that seeks to disrupt and to claim the power that is available, that power that is just ours. Which I have to say will not happen if we interpret his message to mean that we find those 8 to 15 and hunker down in our bubbles, cozy villages, let alone our palaces. Many of you are likely familiar with Margaret Mead's quote about how a small group of people can change the world. But studies show us that actually social change happens when small groups of people interact with other small groups of people. And the change happens in that grand interchange. If you just stick to yourself, the change doesn't actually happen. Small groups interacting with other small groups, and then a great sea change. Long building, but also suddenly. Our world is changing so quickly. Here in northern Colorado, our world here, the landscape, it's shifting. Every day I look out my window, it looks totally different. I live in the southeast. The population is booming, and demographics are changing, and our values are being tested. We, from Windsor to Wellington and Timnath to CSU and everywhere in between, we are trying to figure out who we're going to be and how, which is just a small version of what's happening in the grand scale of our whole world. And as Howard Thurman says, all around us, worlds are dying and worlds are being born. It is an incredible time to be alive, and also an incredible time to wake up to our power and to exercise the fullness of our collective power, that we might be a part of creating the future that remains open. A crown is placed upon our heads, and it charges us still with the call of courageous love for our time. So let us take that next breath, though our lungs be weary, and together let us keep growing. Amen. Blessed be.